The Internet Multicasting Service presents the National Press Club Luncheon with speaker Rudolph Giuliani.
Our guest speaker today is a practitioner of America's favorite political sport these days, reinventing government. Everybody seems to be doing it. Vice President Dole, the Congress, are all trying to reinvent the federal government. Mayor Rudolph Giuliani of New York is reinventing city government, Republican style. The mayor's new urban agenda calls for New Yorkers to practice what Republicans preach for all Americans, including those on welfare, self-reliance. No more looking to Albany and Washington to solve the Big Apple's problems. No, Mayor Giuliani believes the city can fix its own wrongs if it's simply freed from the shackles of those darn state and federal mandates. He'll talk a lot about that today. Already the mayor can claim some rather remarkable achievements. He's balanced budgets. He's cut the growth in city spending for the first time in many, many years. He's lowered some taxes. He's removed 14,000 workers from the city payroll through a severance system. He's won productivity concessions from the municipal unions. He's privatizing city services. He's reforming welfare. He's reducing the crime rate. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Mayor Giuliani also has demonstrated adroit political dexterity. As the first Republican mayor of New York in decades, he endorsed the losing cause of Governor Mario Cuomo, the liberal democratic icon, last year. If that didn't turn out to be such a smart move, the mayor now is taking a new look at his own party's contract with America. But that's the way the game of politics is played in New York. You may remember John Lindsay, who was elected the mayor of New York in the 60s as a Republican, and he came out as a Democrat. Well, Mayor Giuliani is still a Republican, and he's a New Yorker through and through. Raised in Brooklyn, he graduated from Manhattan College and magna cum laude from New York University in 1968. His career kind of bounced back and forth between New York and Washington and the Reagan administration. And, of course, you all know he gained national prominence as U.S. attorney in Manhattan with his tough and successful prosecutions of political corruption, Wall Street crime, and the mob. Known as a bare-knuckles political brawler, Mayor Giuliani is in the process of recasting his image. The new Giuliani is friendlier, a nicer guy, more conciliatory, cooperative, if not quite warm and fuzzy, but he's trying to get there. However, the mayor can tell you much better than I about himself, and it's a great pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, the mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani.
Just get out of here. Give me a chance to speak. Isn't that warm and fuzzy? I thought, thank you very much for having me here. The last time I spoke here, I was the United States Attorney, and I arrived at National Airport a little bit late, and I got into a taxi cab, and I ripped my pants on a wire in the back of the taxi cab. And my pants were ripped about halfway down, and I was bleeding profusely. The taxi driver took me to a tailor, and 5 minutes late already for getting here, I was at a tailor shop about four blocks away, and I handed over my pants, and I was inside waiting, and he actually stitched up the pants and put a patch on it, and I came here, and I began my address by telling the story and saying that I was very, very grateful, because I wasn't sure that would happen in New York City with a taxi driver. The next day when I returned to my office, I had about 1,000 cards, and the New York Taxi Association that wanted to visit with me protesting my insensitive remark. That was the beginning of my education in being mayor of New York City. So I thank you for that help. It began a whole process of trying to be very careful about what you say and always failing somehow or other. I'm here today with a message to Washington from America's cities. And really, it is very simply, just set us free to solve our own problems, free to spend our own money in our own way. On at least, I think, three separate occasions in the last number of years, Americans have said that they want to see a fundamental restructuring of their government, particularly the relationship between Washington and the states and the cities. I believe with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, the electorate at least in part was saying that. And with the election of Bill Clinton in 1992, at least on this point, saying very much the same thing. They wanted to see a limitation on the role of the federal government and an expansion of the role of local governments and state governments. And there's no question that in the 1994 congressional elections, a very similar message came through from the American people. And I don't think that is the product of particular political ideology or anything else. I think that is a sense that people who live in the rest of this country outside of Washington want more control over what happens in their lives, and they recognize that if more and more power and discretion is returned to the government closest to them, they're going to have more of that control. And I believe they do want to see a reduction in the power of the federal government, and they want to see more autonomy for states and localities. I think we've entered a new political era in which there's a consensus between Republicans and Democrats. How exactly you interpret this consensus is a very, very interesting debate. But I think there is consensus that the federal government has to limit its role, and a consensus that programs and policies work best when they're tailored to specific local needs. And that means there should be local control and local decision-making. Very, very interesting. You go back to the Constitution. I mean, the 10th Amendment was all but forgotten in the last 40 to 50 years. Once again, I believe the 10th Amendment is being understood, explained, and thought about. The amendment spells out the proper role for the federal government. And it says simply, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. The federal government was established as a limited government. The states' government were the residuary of all the additional power that wasn't passed on to the federal government. Congress is now wrestling with a whole range of initiatives, the end result of which should be a reversal of the federal government's expansion that began with the Great Depression. It's a new way of looking at American cities. It's a new way of seeing American cities, not just as creators of problems, but as problem solvers. We now have an opportunity to create a more complete set, I believe, of complementary governments, a federal government, a state government, local governments, that each have more of an opportunity to participate in solving the problems that they are presented with. As we move into the 21st century, the demands of the world marketplace, I think, require a stronger group of cities in America. As the American economy becomes a more international economy, and that is happening every single day, cities become more and more important to the ability of America to compete in that international economy. If Washington leaves more wealth and more discretion in cities, that wealth will circulate, stimulating the economy, creating jobs, and creating greater prosperity. Part of the problem that I think we face is that America didn't start really as a country of cities. And there's been a tension throughout the history of this country between the agrarian ideal and the reality of urbanization. Cities just haven't been as important to America as they've been to Europe. In Europe, if you think back, there were cities before there were nations. Before there was Greece, there was Sparta and Athens. Before there was Italy, there was Rome, and then the city-states of the Renaissance. Before there was England, there was the city of London. Most of Europe developed from cities into nations. Americans and America developed somewhat differently. We developed with the romanticized ideal of the frontier and its impact on our culture and values. Many people came to America to escape the old world, the urban world, and they wanted large spaces, and they wanted more freedom. They wanted more self-reliance. But cities have played a very, very important role in our development, and they're becoming more critically important to us. Our fundamental concepts about governance, art, commerce, social order, much of that has been shaped in American cities, even if we haven't recognized how central they are to our existence. I think now is the time, particularly with the demands in our economy and our need to compete, now is the time for us to kind of overcome this ambivalence that we've had about American cities and to understand just how they fit in the American government and in the American economy, and to realize that the increasing globalization of the economy makes, as I said before, cities even more important and more fundamental to the ability of the American economy to perform. Very often, it isn't America competing against Canada, or America competing against Japan, or America competing against Europe. It's New York competing against London or Toronto. It's Los Angeles competing against Hong Kong. Much of the world sees us through our cities. And as this globalized economy becomes closer and closer interlinked, cities become even more important, which means that there has to be an understanding of what has to be done for cities in order to make them survive and grow. I think at the heart of any kind of new urban agenda is the notion that the federal government, state governments, and city local governments have to sort out their responsibilities and each perform their core functions, and as much as possible not intrude into the role of other governments. The political revolution in Washington that has taken place has caused concern about the prospect of reduced federal aid for cities. In fact, I think there are opportunities here that can help us make some very fundamental changes in the direction of both city government and federal government. One of the things that can be done is Congress can free the nation's cities from unnecessary federal direction, and not just direction, but dictation. American cities are ready for that. Maybe they weren't ready for it 30, 40 years ago. Certainly, cities could not deal with the Depression by themselves. They needed the federal government to handle many of the problems that emerged from the Depression. Cities couldn't fight the Second World War. Only a federal government can wage a war. Cities had shown themselves and state governments inadequate to deal with the pressures and the difficulties of moving from the promise of civil rights to the reality of civil rights. But that was our history. That isn't our present. City governments now are much more mature, much more capable. Very often the innovations that occur in city governments before they occur at the federal level. Mayors like Mayor Rendell in Philadelphia, and Mayor Reardon in Los Angeles, and Mayor Daley in Chicago are strong, effective, and innovative political leaders. So whatever our history and our difficulties, we have a different set of relationships now. And therefore, I think this is our opportunity to have a much more complementary relationship between the governments that exist. So I'd like to suggest 9 things for your consideration, things that can be done that will help establish a different role for cities. The first thing that Washington must do is to end, as much as possible, unfunded mandates, which have undermined the balance the Constitution sought to achieve between what was supposed to be a limited federal government and a much more fulsome state and local government. Instead of playing a role complementary to state and local governments, by creating these mandates and not funding them, Washington has really assumed the role of dictator rather than complementary government. Washington now recognizes the problem. And this is an area of remarkable agreement between groups that don't agree about too much else. In 1992, then-Governor Bill Clinton said he wanted to restructure the relationship between Washington and the states. And he talked then about doing away with unfunded mandates. As president, in his recent State of the Union address, he talked again about doing away with unfunded mandates. Speaker Gingrich made passage of an unfunded mandates bill a key element of the contract with America, and the majority leader similarly has called the passage of the unfunded mandates bill, doing away with them in futuro, a step in the right direction and a dusting off of the 10th Amendment. And earlier this month, the president signed that bill, noting that it's time for Congress to stop passing on to the states the cost of decisions that are made in Washington. The president is right. Senator Dole is right, Speaker Gingrich is right, and this is something on which, remarkably, they agree. But now there's another step
that needs to be taken. It's not good enough to just say we're not going to have unfunded mandates in the future. We have got to go back and take a look at the ones that exist and do away with as many of them as possible. 50, or based on how you calculate this, maybe as much as 60 or 65% of the budget of New York City, which is a budget in excess of $30 billion, is mandated by the federal government, by the state government, or by a court decision interpreting laws that emanate from either the federal or the state government. Now, let me give you a few examples. A federal mandate requires us, in essence, to spend, or may require us to spend, somewhere between $8 and $9 billion to build a water filtration plant. Now, that's despite the fact that the quality of New York City's water is so good, we could bottle it and sell it. It probably surpasses the water quality in any other major city in the United States and in most parts of Europe and Asia. But in spite of that, a federal mandate, in essence, requires us to build a filtration plant or to engage in large acquisition of land in upstate New York, both of which will cost enormous amounts of money, which, if left alone, we would accomplish some of that, but we could accomplish it in our own way. And a federal court mandate requires New York City to spend $175 million a year, this may not be the best place to mention this, to purchase daily newspapers for inmates in the city jails. You like, well, I mean, it's 175,000. Did I say 175 million?
Yeah.
I got you even more excited. It's 175,000 that we spend. And we spend $400,000 based on a federal mandate again to clean the windows of city jails, not once, not twice, but four times a year. So far, I've been mayor for 16 months and nobody's cleaned the windows at City Hall. But we spend $400,000 a year required to clean the windows four times a year of the city jail. Similarly, several years ago, a prior city administration, pressured by the ongoing, in essence, federal court receivership of our prison system, of our correction system, agreed to build an elaborate facility to provide prisoners with warmer food. The basis for all this was that the food being served in the city jails was deemed by the court to be insufficiently warm. As a result, the federal court has assumed control for regulating the temperature of food served to city jail inmates. And then New York City, of course, pays the bill, not the federal government, not the federal court. Let me tell you what the bill is now that confronts the city to have warmer food. It will be somewhere between $300 and $350 million to build this facility that emerges, in essence, from a federal mandate. Now, my administration is going to go back to court and to seek relief from that consent decree and mandate. Now, if we succeed, something different happens. Then the mayor and the city council can take that $300 million, $350 million and make a political decision about it, talking about political with a small p. Should that money be used to build schools, we could build somewhere between 10, 15, maybe as many as 18 schools with that money. Or should it be used to rebuild and remodel every playground in the city? Or a combination of two of those things? Or should it be invested in our infrastructure? Or in police? Or in courts? Or in some combination of all of these things, including some portion of it used to improve the food quality in prisons, but not at the level of $300 to $350 million? So the point is that as much as possible, these mandates should be removed so that local governments that have active democratic processes for making these decisions make these decisions closer to home. Same thing is true with another court decision, in this case emanating from state law, that has us running a school system in which we end up spending, out of the $8 billion that we spend on schools, which is an enormous amount of money, more than the budget of most states, we end up spending about $20,000 to $22,000 per special education student, which leaves us with only $5,000 per every other student in the school system. That emerges because of a complex group of court decisions and mandates, which we would like to be free of, so that we could spend somewhat more money on mainstream students and somewhat less money, although still a very, very adequate amount of money, on special education students. We can't make those judgments for ourselves. And that's why this movement to do away with unfunded mandates, which sounds like a little bit of a technocrat phrase, is such an important one to allowing decision-making to take place at the local level, and really restoring some form of democracy to local governments. Just like doing away with unfunded mandates, a second thing that could be done is to, as much as possible, replace categorical grants from Washington with block grants, because in essence, you're doing the same thing when you do that. Rather than dictating the way in which the money has to be spent, to give that money to what are sophisticated political processes so that we can make the decision that in New York we would rather spend the money in one area and the emphasis maybe in Los Angeles would be somewhat different. Also, in the case of large cities, block grants, by and large, should go directly to the cities, cities as large as New York or Philadelphia or Chicago or Los Angeles. And the reason for that is very, very simple. To funnel the money through the state just means you now have three bureaucracies involved in the division of that money rather than just two bureaucracies, federal and local, and much more money is reserved for the purpose for which, even within the broad category of a block grant, it's being ultimately sent to the city. Anytime you can eliminate a middleman or woman, you save money. And that's why block grants should go directly to large cities rather than through states. The fourth thing that should be considered, which often isn't, in terms of figuring out how to return more authority and the ability to carry out those decisions to cities, is to think about cities when you think about tax reform, and to think about them in a somewhat different way. For decades, Washington has taken local money out of the local economy, dictated solutions to local problems, and then, with regard to some of our large cities, return less money than you take from us in the first place. New York City winds up losing $7 billion every year in an exchange that amounts to just kind of a recycling of money. The state of New York gives $14 billion more to the federal government than it receives back from the federal government. The city of New York accounts for $8 to $9 billion of that $14 billion. What we're trying to do with the new urban agenda is to show that American cities are not coming to Washington begging. We come to Washington subsidizing a lot of what happens in the rest of this country. And what we're asking for is more equity in the consideration of what should be returned to us. But also part of the reason why we end up having a deficit with the federal government is because of the progressive income tax. Every time you raise the progressive income tax, a city like New York is hurt, because more of the wealth from New York comes to the federal government and then less comes back. And every time you find ways of decreasing it, you leave more money in our local economy. So when you're considering tax reform, and when cities are arguing for tax reform, that's something that has to be taken into consideration. And the same thing is true with any kind of reduction in the capital gains tax. In the past, cities focused almost exclusively on just asking for aid from Washington in the form of money given to Washington. Tax reform can accomplish very, very much of that same thing if cities are taken into consideration when we do tax reform. Fifth, and maybe most importantly, is to understand that core functions means that although the federal government should reduce its role in some of the areas that we've talked about and limit its role and return more of the authority and power and decision-making to local government, there are areas in which the federal government has the sole responsibility for carrying out that function. And one of those areas is the area of immigration. Only the federal government can patrol our borders. Only the federal government can conduct foreign policy with the nations that might be nations in which there are large flows of people to the United States illegally or in a status that eventually turns out to be undocumented. And only the federal government can deport people who are illegally in the United States. Here, the federal government should be expanding its role, not contracting its role, devoting more resources to protecting our borders, upgrading technology, engaging in foreign policy that's geared toward creating legal flows of immigration, because sometimes you find where there are illegal flows, one of the things that happens and one of the things that's going on is the legal flow of immigration isn't working effectively. And finally, the federal government has to devote much more attention and many more resources to the whole process of deportation. I'm really deeply concerned about this because I believe that at the core of the frustration over the federal government's failure to deal with illegal immigration, we have movements like Proposition 187 in California. which is a misguided approach and one that is very, very simplistic and engages in a form of scapegoating. It's a measure that would deny services to illegal immigrants without any consideration of the dangers that it would create for American cities. Let me point out just one flaw in it and then how to cure it. In New York City, we have a large number of students in our public school system whose parents are illegal or undocumented aliens. I don't know the number. No one really knows precisely the number. I would guess it is somewhere around 40 or 50,000. At first blush, what you would say is, we have enough in terms of our own obligations to people that are legally in the United States, or our citizens, why should we be paying for the education of children who are illegal and undocumented? But I want you to think for a moment, what would happen if Proposition 187 became federal law, and in New York, we would have to turn in the names of all of the parents of all of those children. What would happen is that those parents would not send their children to public schools any longer, and they wouldn't send them to any school. And we would have 30, 40, 50,000 youngsters on the streets of the city. It would be a very, very dangerous situation for them. It would be a dangerous situation for the other people in the city. And the fact is, we can't do anything about it. It's only the federal government that can take the steps that are necessary either to stop their parents from coming in the first place or doing something about it when they're here. And let me just give you quickly some statistics. It's estimated that there are nearly 3.4 million undocumented aliens living in the United States. 3.4 million. Yet the federal government deported only 49,000 people last year. In New York City, the estimate is 400,000 undocumented aliens. And for the area surrounding New York City, there were only 772 deportations last year. What that means is, if something like Proposition 187 became the law, I would be required as the mayor of the city of New York to turn in the names of the parents of the children in public schools, thousands and thousands and thousands of names, which would be added to a list, a pile that's probably this large, of names that are already there, of the people who commit crimes in New York City, whose names are turned over to the Immigration and Naturalization Service, that the Immigration and Naturalization Service doesn't have the resources to deport. So it seems to me the most sensible approach is, let's put the concentration on all of those names of people who have committed crimes, who are drug dealers, violent criminals, in our prisons, in our jails, and have those people in the process of deportation before we start worrying about parents who are using schools, before we start worrying about people who are victims of crime who are seeking redress for an injury, or people who are ill and are seeking treatment. I think it's a far more practical and a far more humane solution. And it really indicates that this process of re-examining the functions of state, local, and federal government is not just a simplistic function of reducing one government and increasing another, but trying to do an honest analysis of what are the core functions of these governments and how can we help each other. A sixth suggestion, another area in which the federal government could be enormously helpful, would be to increase its role in dealing with drugs for very much of the same reasons as illegal immigration. It's only the federal government that can deal with the foreign governments from whence a lot of the drugs emerge. It's only the federal government that can deal with border patrol, which is one of the things that has to be increased if we're going to reduce the flow of drugs into this country. And finally, it's only really the scope of federal law enforcement that can deal with the kinds of conspiracies and the wide nature of the distribution of drugs in this country. That isn't to say that local government and state government doesn't have a very important role to play. But it's a role that we can't possibly play alone, and we need a federal government that is increasing its concentration in this area rather than one that is either ignoring it or decreasing its concentration. Seventh, I believe that we have to have welfare reform. It is critical for urban America to reform the welfare system. It's also critical for us not to be afraid to do it. I believe that in New York City, we have begun the hard work of changing a system that has led too many New Yorkers into a life of dependency. Beginning this year, we started a workfare program, which turns out to be the largest workfare program in America. Now, I should add that everything in New York is, by and large, the largest in America because we have so many people. But the program is founded on the concept of reciprocity. For every benefit, there's an obligation. For every right, a duty. Workfare offers assistance, it offers dignity, it offers hope, all of which can be found in a job. Our workfare program says that welfare should be a temporary helping hand, not a way of life. I'm pleased that here in Washington, lawmakers are recognizing the need, as is the administration, to give cities and states more freedom to design welfare programs that meet local needs. However, I have to point out that the welfare bill that passed the House, which hopefully will be modified in the Senate and eventually in negotiations with the administration, that it has some very good points and it has some very bad points. And I'd like to briefly point out the ones that I think are good and the ones that I think are harmful. I believe the bill correctly strips welfare of its entitlement status. And most importantly, in doing that, it embraces the concept of reciprocity. Recipients are being told, even philosophically, but then that works its way into the way a program is administered, that from the first day they receive their benefits, that society expects them to return to the workforce, and that for this benefit, there are obligations that are going to flow to them, maybe not today, but eventually. And the bill places limits on the length of time people can receive benefits to reinforce that sense of reciprocity. Restoring to welfare over a period of time its initial purpose as a temporary helping hand, not a way of life. On the other hand, I think the bill unwisely dictates that federal money cannot be used to provide cash payments to teenage mothers who have children out of wedlock. And I think it unwisely tries to cut off benefits to children whose mothers already are receiving welfare benefits. These provisions punish children. They are based on a questionable premise, at least in my view, that changing the rules of welfare will substantially reform sexual behavior. I think there are more fundamental and more important things that have to be done to make those changes. But even if it were true that somehow over a period of time these rules could change sexual behavior, it would take many, many years before those changes would become part of the reality of the way in which people view what's going on in their communities. And in the meantime, these provisions hurt children dramatically. And finally, they leave cities in the position of having to deal with these problems without proper funding in order to do it. These problems notwithstanding, I believe that the welfare bill does further the process. It furthers the debate. It raises the challenge that a system that is failing, we have to face up to, and we have to try to turn it around. And I urge the House, the Senate, and President Clinton to forge a final bill that strips welfare of its entitlement status, that embraces in a very, very strong and out front way reciprocity and workfare, but that gives states and cities the flexibility to decide how to impose these time limits, and that ceases to use arbitrary removal of benefits as a way of controlling behavior. Eighth, I believe that we have to reform Medicaid, which costs New York City about $2.4 billion a year. New York City spends too much on Medicaid. Also, we are not treated equitably in the way in which the way in which the federal government handles the reimbursement of Medicaid to the city of New York. Governor Pataki made an excellent proposal that I endorse and I think should be seriously considered. Both his budget and mine will save the federal government billions and billions of dollars over a period of time on Medicaid expenditures in New York State and New York City. In return for that, some of that money should be reserved so that we can straighten out the inequitable formula that now exists in reimbursing states like New York, like California, the larger states with the larger urban areas. It acts as an incentive for us to reform Medicaid, and it acts as a way in which to redress what is an inequity recognized by the president and just about everyone else. And finally, I think it's time for the federal government to understand that investment in the infrastructure of American cities is an investment in the future of America, because cities are the way in which you sell America very, very often. In the last week alone, we had three Republican presidential candidates that came to New York to raise money for their campaigns. And in the coming months, I expect that all of them will come to New York for fundraising and campaigning purposes. President Clinton will come, as he often does, and he's a very welcome guest, and Vice President Gore and the First Lady. And they're all very welcome. And New York City is the home of a large number of Democratic votes and a lot of Republican money. So they're all they all come to New York, and we're very gratified that they come to the city. But I hope that the candidates will do more than think about raising money. I hope they will realize that if New York City is such a terrific place to raise money, It's also a very good place in which to invest a lot of care, a lot of concern, and it has an awful lot to do with the future of America. I urge them to take a stronger and a more substantive look at New York and America's cities, and to make cities an important part of this presidential campaign. What can be done for them? We don't have to follow the old formulas. There are ways in which applying what you might consider to be typical Republican philosophy or typical Democratic philosophy can help cities. But I urge the presidential candidates to talk about those issues again. I'd like to conclude by pointing out to you that in many, many ways, our cities are ahead of the federal government. Many of the things that are being debated now in Washington are things that we're doing. We're doing workfare. We're doing privatization. We have taken the concept of the federal crime bill before there was a federal crime bill, put it into effect in New York, where we have the largest police department we've ever had, and we have prevention programs that try to help young people, and we've had the largest decreases in crime than we've ever had in certain categories last year, and that's continuing into this year. I can stand here telling you, and I do this as an advertisement, that when the FBI crime statistics come out this year, New York City will not be in the top 50 cities in America for crime. We'll be one of the largest, we'll be one of the safest large cities in America. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But one of the reasons is that we have, for some time now, incorporated the theory of emphasize substantial number of police, emphasize corrections and punishment, emphasize also, however, prevention programs that give young people some hope that there can be a future other than drugs and violent crime. So I think it's time to realize that American cities are more than just problems, they're assets. They produce a tremendous amount of wealth for America in dollars. I think they actually produce even more than just dollars. They produce, to a very large extent, the definition of America as a cultured, civilized place that understands the practicalities of life and also understands the beauty of life. So I close with the thought of Lewis Mumford, who once observed, cities remain man's greatest work of art. And I think that's true, and I think America is beginning to understand that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Now the hard part. Some questions. Some questions. New York always seems to be having problems. Can you tell us, in your view, what is the city's core problem? Is it really race, welfare, desertion by the middle class, income disparity, divided responsibilities in the metropolitan area? What is the central problem?
The central problem of New York City is not realizing that New York City is not a city of problems. That New York City is a city of assets that far outweigh every single one of those problems. We're a city that produces more wealth than any city in America. We're a city that is the world capital for so many different endeavors, whether it's finance, communications, entertainment, and understanding that we can use those assets to help address each and every one of those problems. And in a way, maybe by talking so much about our problems, we've sort of built in the stereotype of cities as being places that are failing. New York City is a place that's succeeding. It's a place that actually does more for America, and I say this in the most respectful way here in Washington, it does more for America than America does for New York City. We sell America more than America sells us. We give more in dollars to America than America sends back to us. We're proud to do that because we think that we have some advantages that allow us to contribute. And what I just said could be said about Philadelphia, Boston, Chicago, Los Angeles, Miami, Houston. I've left out a city and I'm going to be in deep trouble by the time I finish. But I think it's the concept of cities that has to change. All of those problems are serious ones. They're all very important ones, and they're ones that we're addressing. But I think we have to change, to some extent, the concept that cities have of themselves and that people outside of cities have of American cities.
Thank you. You, questioners, asked this. You are engaged in the largest effort to contract out city services to the private sector. How do you increase such activities, and keep the municipal unions happy.
I have a great commissioner of labor, Randy Levine, who was with me earlier today. And I should say, in all fairness, we have in New York City very responsible municipal labor leaders who see themselves as leaders of the city and understand, to a very large extent, the economy we're in and what can be done realistically to help their membership and what they could insist on for narrow political purposes but would ultimately destroy their membership. They understand that we don't have huge amounts of money, that we're in a situation in which we have a budget deficit where we're going to have to reduce. And they work with us to try to obtain for their membership realistic things that can be done. When I first came into office, it was clear that we had to reduce the workforce by somewhere between 15 and 20,000 workers. The prior administration had tried to do that on three occasions and had failed, and the city had to do that. The municipal labor unions, once convinced that it had to be done, work with us so that we could do a severance program for those workers. They were taken out of the workforce, but they were taken out by being offered benefits and being offered help the way you would do in a large American corporation. Those are the things that you can do if you work together. And I've found one of the most satisfying relationships that we've had is with the leaders of the municipal unions, who, if you are honest with them, you're straight with them, you show them your books and you let them examine it up and down so that there's no hidden money, they'll then be realistic about trying to solve problems.
A couple of other questions on privatization. With proposed cuts in Medicare and Medicaid threatening to cause even more problems for people to gain health care, do you really believe that privatizing New York City's public hospital helps address that crisis? And secondly, we'll talk about housing, too. With HUD Secretary Henry Cisneros proposing to switch to a voucher system for families needing housing assistance, how can privatizing or not building public housing units in New York City accommodate people who need housing and health care?
I should have said an answer to the earlier question, but I can do it in this one. Privatization, to me, means competition. It doesn't mean that you necessarily always privatize or always utilize the option of privatization. It means, however, that that option should be open because it improves government services. The classical example of privatization, which comes out of Osborne's book and is the sort of the philosophical basis for how privatization is done, was in Phoenix, Arizona, when they privatized the sanitation department, split the city up into districts. The city sanitation department lost all the bids the first time around, or all but one, I believe, and now the city sanitation department has a majority of the bids and a majority of the routes because it made itself more competitive than the private companies. That's privatization. Ultimately, the city workforce is roughly the same, but the city workforce is doing it for less money than the private sector would do by and large. Sometimes it doesn't work that way. Sometimes it does. In New York City, what we have is an excess. We went uncontrollably in the direction of the government dominating the economy of the city, much more so than any other American city. So we have 17 hospitals owned by the city of New York, 11 of them acute care hospitals. Los Angeles has two. Chicago has two. No other American city has more than one. We have 11. 20 to 25% of the people that are in a hospital bed in New York City are in a hospital bed owned and operated by the city of New York. That's a huge percentage. We've gone too far.